This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored in part by TradeStation. Check out the App Store. You can find some amazing trading apps over at TradeStation.com.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of The Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Janet Yellen's first meeting is a choke. Sends markets reeling. China's woes are intensifying. Food prices on the rise. And our guest today, Jack Swager of the Little Book of Market Wizards. Great author, great insight. All this and much more on episode number 356 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hey, it is Andrew Horowitz here, and it is a wonderful week. We've had great weather down here. Spent a little time down at the Sony Tennis Classic. We went early, just for the afternoon, watched Rafael play some warm-up. And boy, that guy's got some forehand. I mean, and you know how I knew it was him? There was all these warm-ups going on and practices, you know, whatever he was playing. And what was amazing was, I out of the corner of my eye, I saw somebody hitting the ball. And we walked over there, and I looked, and I saw this just wicked, incredibly wicked forehand with just topspin, but just off the ground kind of move and over the top with the shoulder and just whipping the ball over the net. And I'm like, man, that looks like Rafael Nadal. And sure enough, it was him. And we watched him just whack it around pretty good. That's impressive to watch a professional at that level at their game. Really amazing. I don't know if he's number one or number two right now, but he's somewhere probably fighting Federer for the position. There's lots that happened this week, and we're also going to get to, in this particular show, we're going to get to all of the, or many of the, stocks that were sent in. You sent us a list of your stocks to check out. We did some analysis on them, and we're going to talk about them. We also have Jack Swager on, and he's going to talk about some of the things about this book. I hope. I have a lot of questions to ask him. It's a very nice, condensed, you know, historically he's written these very large and very intensive books, and this has been all distilled down to the essence, and I've been kind of buzzing through here. It's much shorter, much easier to read, and I think it's something that you'll enjoy, and I have some things I want to talk to him about what made some of these investors and these wizards, well, wizardly is the right word. So we're going to find out more about that. But a couple things I want to talk to you about beforehand. You know, we saw that Janet Yellen, if you saw any of the replays, or maybe you watched it live, of her conference on Wednesday, where she came out and discussed the recent actions of the Fed and their outlook, et cetera, and that they obviously, when they announced they're going to be reducing down the bond buying by a total of another $10 billion, so bring it down, as they had said and as they had promised, month by month, they're going to be bringing it down by $10 billion and hopefully out of it by the end of the year. But the question was, you know, when is this all going to kind of, you know, when is it ending? What do you see? What do you foresee? And there was a comment that she made that really took markets off, I think, off guard. And it was about the concept of extended period and, you know, a long time. You know, the Fed has taken out the 6.5% number that they had targeted for unemployment. Now they're using a different process, which is really going to confuse the heck out of the markets, because each and every data point now is probably going to be something that people are going to be looking at saying, oh, it's bad, it's good, it's bad. Now you have to add them all together and look at it much more difficult. When there was an easy target of 6.5%, an inflation rate that they targeted, you could easily know when you get there. But now you have two things. You have the Fed basically backtracking on what they had promised, so that's an issue. And the second thing is now making it a process that you really don't know what they're looking for. So now markets can just jam around in all sorts of different directions. Here's the thing. when she had talked about in this conference this week, well, what is an extended period and what are we looking at? And she said, again, this is an unknown and long time periods and extended times and was, considered to be sometime way out in the future. Well, she said the word, she gave it an actual time. She said 6 months is probably the time period that we're looking for raising interest rates. Well, that would take us into about, let's call it June of 2015. Markets didn't like that because it was apparent at that point that the Fed is determined to bring interest rates back to, or at least start trying to move back to a normal level, and the stimulus is going to be shut down. That is something that was a mystery for a while. What was the time? What was the length of period? How long was it going to be? It was just out there, and it was kind of just generally accepted as sometime way in the future. And now that she put a time period on it, I think it changed a little bit of the concept and the idea of when we could expect this, and markets took it hard. As a matter of fact, gold has been falling all throughout the week. We talked about this Sunday night. I put out a tweet, and I said that, this 1352 level, 1351, is really a vulnerable area, and you get below that, you could see a problem. As a matter of fact, it was about 1360 at the time, and at 1360 or so, I said, you know what? There is a hole here. There is an area of just no volume of accumulation that happened, that if we fall below about the 59, 58 level, it's going to be a quick move down to 50, and that happened, and now we saw it move even lower down to the 1320s, and this is a situation where the dollar really ramped up after that at the exact moment that she blurted out 6 months. And I must say, she did it in a way that was, it seems she was nervous and she was caught off guard. It was her first meeting. Obviously, the prep for the meeting, maybe she didn't remember, maybe whatever it was. I am certain that over the next few weeks, we're going to see a lot of participants come out and say something like, well, she didn't really mean 6 months. 6 months was a guess. It was an estimate, but that's not engraved in stone. And you're going to see a lot of the bulls out there talking about how, markets didn't read it right. And you're going to see, of course, the Fed marchers come out and talk about how that's not exact numbers and it's all up to the economics, et cetera. So keep your eye on that. It's going to be a very interesting situation when we see how that plays out. But overall, what I think we're going to notice here from this is that you're going to probably have the dollar continue to rise unless something dramatic happens. And that's obviously going to cause some problems. At the same time, that we saw that China had removed the very, very tight trading range on, they call it the band, the daily band on the currency from China. And this is now being relaxed a bit. And again, we talked about this last week. The big issue here is that it never made any sense at all for China to keep on increasing their currency value when the rest of the world was dropping it, even though there's a lot of pressure on the rest of the world. When their markets and their economic markets, that is, start to see some softening, you have to wonder, why didn't they go and do something sooner? And any other country would have. But now they're in a pickle. Now the problem is that we're seeing that there are defaults happening. Developers are in real trouble. There's companies that are seeing a lot more problems with their loans. The shadow banking system surely shows that there is a considerable amount of stress on their markets. And in the loans that were outstanding and that have been issued really are showing signs of having problems. Now, the reaction that you would see, that you would usually see on a situation with a Fed statement as they were, where stocks would be down and bond prices down, yields higher and gold moving lower, actually played out. Interesting, because the correlations that we've seen historically were really getting very wonky for a while. And all of a sudden, we're starting to see those actually play out in a way that is normal, quote unquote. Anyway, we have a good amount to talk about when it comes to the stocks that you sent in. Thank you so much for all these. I have some comments also. We're going to spend some time with the listener questions right now. and a few things that I think are very important. Before we do so, I want to mention that TradeStation is the number one sponsor of this episode and our program right now, and I want to thank them very much. TradeStation has an incredible program. I've been mentioning them week in and week out for a while now because this is something that I really want you to make sure that you get to experience. I don't know of any other software charting system that has the plugins like they have that are available from the Trading App Store. And what's nice about that is that you get to try out all sorts of different indicators. You get to find what works for your kind of style of investing, whether it's a strategy that you can put right on the chart to show you when to buy and sell, short, go long, whatever it is, whether it's for futures or stocks or Forex, or maybe even you want to use something that's a little bit more of a design that was made by a professional in terms of an indicator that it blends in some of the things that they're looking at. This is all available on the Trading App Store over at TradeStation. I want to thank them not only for sponsoring, but I also want to thank them for bringing such a great program available for you. You can check out this and get 90 days of free trading, 90 days of a free platform, and check it. It's kind of like a trial. Go to TradeStation.com. Better yet, if you want to go directly, go right to the show notes on this episode. And what you'll find is that there is a link right there that'll take you over to get your free trial. So check it out over at TradeStation or go to TheDisciplinedInvestor.com and you can find out everything that you need to know right there. All right, so let's start with some of the questions that we have. First is from David G. He says, I use FinViz to screen in Yahoo Finance for the key stats. The screen I've been using is on ideas I gain, actually from my book, volume peg ratio below 20-day below 20-day moving average. I also use the price between 5 and 15. Once I have a list of stocks, I review each on Yahoo Finance to check the company's financials. Good start. You know, you have all that going on. I'll tell you some things you need to look for there, but good start. And then I set my buy price 5% lower than the current trading price. Recently, I have been using the 52-week high stocks and checking out why they're going up, and if it looks like the buyers will continue to push the prices higher. Okay, let me give you a couple of things about this. Why are you limiting, first of all, this $5 to $15 price range? There are plenty of stocks out there that trade at a much higher price, and price really isn't necessarily an indicator of a quality stock. So when you limit yourself to a range of price, now I understand maybe, and I agree with, that you don't want to maybe buy certain stocks and find a screen of quality stocks that maybe have, let's say, a price lower than 5. More importantly, probably you don't want to find that volume on average has been very, very low. But pricing on the upside, so if you eliminate that $15 top side, I bet you'll find a lot more stocks that are going, you know, that are much better. Now, obviously, I'll mention, I think it's important, that FinViz has a great screener. Yahoo has some great information. But at the same time, maybe think about investing a couple of dollars into maybe a platform that can give you some of that has some scrub data and data that's been more refined, because you really don't know with the freebies exactly what you're getting. In fact, just to mention it, that TradeStation has a great screener that you can screen on much of the things that you're looking at. But aside from that, the other thing is that, you know, when you look at your sell positioning, you know, you look at, okay, well, where am I going to sell? What is your way of looking at selling? Well, you can look at support and resistance. You can look at things like news items. You can put a stop on, like a trailing stop on there. And I think that the things that you're looking at are good, but they're very short-term oriented. Now, if you are thinking, David, of just being a short-term trader, okay, well, I'll go with that. But at the same time, I think you're limiting your overall by having the price where it is at set at the 5 to 15, and you can do a lot better for yourself. All right, let's see what else we got here. We have a question that came in from Warren. Warren wants to know about Constellation Brands. Now, what we did here was we put together our classical level of fundamentals and also our technicals, and we created back, like we do for Oktoberfest, you know, what does the stock look like and how exactly is this going to play out? And so I wanted to kind of go over some of this right now with you. So let's take a look at Constellation Brands. This is a company that is involved in the alcoholic beverage in North America and Europe, Australia, New Zealand. Has a whole great portfolio of brands. market cap is about $15.5 billion. It's overall expectations of earnings have been somewhat choppy, but yet doing okay. The fact is that we're seeing that the EPS and revenue growth here in the last several quarters has been increasing dramatically, which is really good to see. And the forward growth estimates are growing very well. There's an overall, of course, we know a target price and a rating that's much higher usually than most. Analysts are targeting approximately the current price of about in the 82 range. And we're seeing that this company has done well to have a good number of surprises on the upside. As a matter of fact, that we're seeing that the estimates were somewhere in the, let's say, back last about 91 cents, and they had a 20% surprise, a 9% surprise. They've pretty much surprised, I would say, almost all the time except one quarter back to 2012. Now, this company is seeing their revenues somewhat, I would say, flat, not seeing a dramatic rise over the last 8 quarters. But again, estimates are showing that this company is going to really show a significant increase in revenues over the next several quarters. Now, if that plays out, you're going to find this stock is priced well, and there's a great opportunity for an opportunity on the upside. And with much of the companies of this nature consolidating and finding ways to bring on other brands, I think this could be an excellent play. Now, in terms of where the stock is and how the stock is going to play out, the charts, well, let's take a look. When you look at the actual levels on the daily, now I want you to look at this if you see the stock chart. One of the things that's interesting about this is it has a really good line of support at 82. Now, back in the beginning of this year, after earnings, it ran up from about 70, 71, after they saw the really good numbers that came out and the nice beat that we talked about a moment ago, you see that this thing, you know, ran right up to about 82, came back and, you know, did a little bit of a dive down as markets came in a bit, down to about 76 and change. Now, what's nice is that we're seeing that our profiles are getting more and more towards the longer-term uptrend. It was a consolidation for a while. It broke out. We see a consolidation again from February through about March. Then you started to see the move back up, and now it's holding very well at about 82. Probably the stock will kind of come in a bit if markets come in back down to the 80, maybe even the 78 level, and then your range is set right there. 84.5 is really the level that you have to look for, and maybe even closer to, I would say probably 85 for a breakout. If you see that, the stock could really move higher. This has been on a run from about the 60s, through about the 80s from last November to now. So the chart is in a clear and defined uptrend here, and it's actually looking pretty good. Then we have a question in from Daniel. He gave me a lot of stocks to look at here. Daniel, thank you so much. We're going to look at a couple of different ones here from you. You asked about Nokia. You asked about JCPenney and a few others. One of the things you mentioned here I think was interesting, and the idea of bricks and mortars would die and would perish soon, and JCPenney outlets soon, you know, seeing all sorts of problems, and maybe they're seeing them maybe with Halloween costumes for sale and being sold and fireworks. And is Costco going to take them over? Let's just take a look at, you know, one thing. JCPenney, you look at revenue and earnings growth, and it is absolutely just a disgusting affair. I mean, the red is ridiculous. The amount of money they're losing and bleeding on a regular basis is incredible. How do you analyze a stock like this? Well, you really can't. Because if you were to look at, well, you can analyze it, but you can't at least give an opinion here. Because if you look at the overall trends here for this, I agree with you. This is really going to see a significant amount of losses. And all we're trying to find right now is potentially the opportunity to find where they can make a turnaround. Now, latest quarter back in February when they reported, they actually had a positive EPS. But it was kind of questionable in terms of, you know, their comparables. That was a big issue. They came out with a plus 22, but when you break it all down and you look at all the things that are going on, the fact of the matter is that it really was still a negative. It did, in fact, beat estimates here. Revenues are still coming down. Revenues have been, according to estimates, you know, revenues this time missed. It was much higher than last, so that was good. But overall, when you look at the actual trend of this, it's a problem. JCPenney as a stock, looking at the actual charts itself, is kind of interesting also, because when you look at the charts on JCPenney, what you're finding is that there was that incredible spike that happened just recently. And then what happened from there? We saw that there was a move from the low down at 5, where there was good support, up to about 9. So 100%, you know, or 75, 80% move up to that point. 950 is clearly a level of resistance. And you're probably going to see a backtrack of this somewhere to about the 7.25 to 735 range, I would say. And then we have to see what happens. If, in fact, you break down from there, you're going to move back down probably to the $6 range where there's some good support there, and we'll see. I don't think this is a great play. I don't think there's anything really to look at that can be discerned as a positive from fundamentals, and I do agree with some of your commentary regarding the bricks and mortars. You also mentioned a few others. I will mention to you the one that I picked out of the bunch because we do like a lot is Ubiquiti Networks, and this is a lot of what they offer is wireless planned community shopping malls and throughout mixed developments around the United States, and they have this very good infrastructure development. They have an excellent product. Their revenues are expected to grow over the next several quarters in the 100% range. Over the next 1-2 quarters, then they're going to back off about 70. Back in the last few quarters, it's a bit of a newer situation here. But if you look at the surprises on earnings and the revenue surprises, they're continually doing very, very well. This is something that is a theme and that we will look for. We want to see how the company is, in fact, looking in terms of their overall potential to beat and to do better overall in terms of opportunity for growth. Now, their P.E. ratio, which is not something we look at individually usually, but it's only 37 when you look at that. And the growth rates of this company are pretty significant. When you look at their growth rates of the next several quarters of 200% on EPS, 100% on revenue, and then 135%, 113%, and then it starts to slow down in the 2015 timeframe where expectations are about 13 to 20%. You probably have a few quarters of this that the stock is going to look really good. Earnings are coming out, let's see, we're looking at in May. So Ubiquiti, which is UBNT, is something I would take a look at. All right, now we got an email from Jared, and he's asking about coal stocks. You know, I got to tell you something. The coal stocks have been problematic, and for good reason. I mean, with China's slowdown and with the fact that the clean energy revolution is on, do you really want to be involved in coal stocks? Have you looked at the revenue growth? Have you looked at the potential for these companies? It looks horrible. Now, the only thing you have going for you here is there is so much negativity. There is so much negative sentiment involved right now in these. That the possibility is that what you're going to find is a significant amount of possibility for EPS surprises, and that would be good for these companies. But you know what? If you take a look at these and you really look closely, these have been all over the place. I mean, this is a under $5 stock. It's very difficult. It's ACI, Arch Coal. And I got to tell you, I would not really be too involved in this. I think that if you want to play this from a very short-term play period, fine. But from a fundamental view and from a relationship to where this is in the big cycle of things, I mean, the expectations are horrible for this stock. This is not something I'd really be involved in. You got about a 395 baseline on this. Probably your top end will be about 450, 460. That's a big range. That's some good numbers. But this is, again, not something I'd really be very excited about investing in. So there's not much you can say about it. It just looks terrible. It looks terrible overall. It's actually more than terrible. You know, the expectations are really pretty awful. Let's go on to the next one. Next one we have here is, let's see, we got, what do we got? This is interesting, Annaly Capital. Annaly Capital is from Charles, and Charles asked about Annaly Capital. Hey, what's the story with this? Now, Annaly Capital is a company that is, of course, a we'll call it in the real estate sector. This is, it manages real estate, which is on behalf of both institutionals and investors. They have mortgage-backed securities. Now, one of the things you're going to have a problem here is if the Fed is and has been continuing to look at dropping and reducing the amount of buying they're doing, there could be some problems here, and they can have a bit of an issue. But this stock has seen a beautiful run from about $10 up to about $11.50 from December. Now, this is not going to be a big mover, but there is a bit of a gap here. You can kind of base out by around 11, 1110 on the chart and move higher. This company has not done well on their EPS. This is a yield play. That's the bottom line. This is a yield play. And if you believe that there is some opportunity for yields to move in a direction that you think, you know, continue to stay low, that's great. But if yields start to change, these are going to be dumped. They had a bit of an erratic past on their EPS in terms of surprise and expectations. Revenues have been better over the last several years than expectations. But still, this is simply a yield play, in my opinion. And as you see the yield curve changing, what's going to happen here is you're going to see this, you know, kind of get dumped on. I'm moving fast because a lot of these. Here's a question from Mike and talking to BOFI, B-O-F-I. This is Bank of Florida Holdings, and this is the Bank of the Internet USA. It's a consumer-focused nationwide savings bank that operates in the internet from a single location in San Diego. Actually, I don't know if it's Bank of Florida, B-O-F-I. This stock has actually shown some really nice growth over time, and we're seeing that the continuation is going to be there, but yet revenue growth is starting to slow down. They've surprised very nicely over the last about 10 quarters, I'll call it. And when I look at this and this particular name, what I'm seeing is that there is a nice amount of I think there's some opportunity here. But at the same time, you have to realize it doesn't really trade very, very much. Now, this is another stock that is going to probably be very much riding the yield curve. Now, on a chart, this is very interesting. So the chart had a really good, as a matter of fact, an excellent, from December through February, a really good consolidation period that it broke out from in the middle of February from about 80 through about 105. It topped out at about 105 and change. We saw that there's a new level of consolidation in terms of range on our altimeters that were built, and then from there it broke down. Maybe it really took about 3 days. It broke down from about 105 to about 95, 92, 91. There's some support there at about the $87 range, not a lot. I think you could see the stock easily come back to about 84, 84 and a half, and then base out there, and then the question is going to be, where does it go from there? Now, what's going to happen here is that, you know, if you do get that, I would think there's going to be a lot of players trying to scoop up some of the positioning there, because we've seen that was prior support all the way back to December. That's good. So take a look at the opportunity when you look at that in terms of the overall, and from there, I think that, you know, if you have your support back, I really don't think I'd be holding this right now. I think there is some question as to you know, the speed and the increase of their revenues and their opportunity moving forward. Now, here's another question coming in, and this is a little bit tough. Again, you know, you're giving me some curveballs, gang. Looking at Rite Aid Corp, symbol RAD, and the symbol is emblematic of companies, as we've talked about earlier, that are in the area of, you know, are brick and mortars going to be here forever, or is this it, okay? This is obviously a retail drugstore chain. Walgreens has been doing incredibly well, and Rite Aid has been, you know, kind of coming in pretty hard. Yes, it did go down into the one some time ago, and it's back up to six. It did have a nice little run in the beginning of this year from about, we'll call it about $4 to about $7. It looks like it's peaking out here. It looks like it kind of took out its top. When you look at fundamentals, again, there's nothing good here. There's nothing good. That doesn't mean the company can't do a turnaround. It can't be a buyout opportunity. You know, it has that kind of thing going for it. But in terms of when you look at this and trying to analyze this stock, let's be honest. There is nothing here that shows us that there is anything good other than the fact that possibly in 2015, there is some upside opportunity where finally the losses are going to slow down, at least from an estimate standpoint. And maybe that's what's driving the name right now. I will tell you that when I look at this and I find that, you know, the stock is jumping around as much as it has, it looks like there's a lot of speculation in this. And I would say that if you have the stock and you see it base out by about the 640 level, 645, maybe that's something to look at. There's been buyers that have been coming in continually at that level. We're showing that we have a level of support there also. But the latest altimeters that we draw, the market profile that we're looking at on a chart, is also showing that it's getting wider. Now, this is the first significant move on the upside that we've seen that has held as nicely as it has. The last one that happened at the end of last year in 2013, where it jumped up from about 520 to about 6, came right back down. And I would suspect that there's not going to be much of a differential with what's going on with this current move. So I kind of apologize. Nothing really substantial to say there. The other one that I got in is Generac. Now, this is from Mike. And Mike asked about Generac. Now, this is a company that manufactures automatic, stationary, standby, and portable generators. Now, one of the things you'll notice with this kind of company, it's kind of a themed kind of company. When you see that the area of storms increase, or maybe you see a hurricane in a particular area, this is the kind of company that gets a real move on the news. The latest surprise on EPS was light by a long shot. And when I look at this stock, what I'm seeing again is that it's had a very erratic span of earnings and revenue. And in fact, it's coming in pretty strong. The revenue expectations over the next several quarters are much lighter than you would like to see. And that's a problem. When you look at the overall, the EPS growth, it's starting to really get lower and lower. And we're actually going to see some negative EPS growth over the next several quarters. So, you know, this is a company that I think is very thematic, and that's how you want to play this. Understand the companies that you're working with, right? This is a thematic-based company that is going to really play on weather conditions, and that's what I would look at this for, because you really can't see anything that's substantial in terms of the outlook. You know, when you're looking at other companies and you're looking like an Under Armour, you're looking at, you know, someone like a Las Vegas Sands or even Ubiquiti, or kind of go down the list of quality companies, these companies don't have the same thing going for it. These companies are, you know, this Generac is, again, very thematic. And I would use that as a trading play. Watch where the trend starts moving and watch what the news is. And that's when you want to play this. Long-term hold, not really my favorite. With us now is Jack Schwager, who has a new book out, you know, on top of the fantastic books in the series on market wizards that he has. He now has a little book of market wizards. I have it right in my hand right now. Jack, this is so, it's cute. I like it.
Yeah, it is. Well, it's an easy read compared to everything else I've written.
Yeah. You know, was it really hard to condense this down and really get
that? No, I mean, that was the theme. That was the whole idea. What I wanted to do was essentially, and this book is in a way an outgrowth of my speaking style, because I had given many talks on the topic of the market, lessons of the market wizards, if you will, as a topic heading. And for that, you have to sort of condense the message of the books into short form. And so the idea was to write a book that was accessible to a really broader, very broad audience, and would serve as an introduction to people who hadn't read any of the market wizard books and may get intimidated looking at it. Even the books are not easy reads, I think, anyway, but they're like 500 pages a piece, and there's like four of them. So here's like one little volume under 200 pages, easy to digest. And so it's basically an introduction which I try to capture the key lessons of from all the other books.
Now, obviously, that as you write these books, time goes on, and you know, you interview people and you talk to the various people out there that are the, you know, the top of their industry, of this industry. And have you found that over the last several years, there's any change in their basic methodologies or the way they look at things? Is anything with maybe the way the world is now compared to where it was, I don't know, you know, one of the first books you wrote, does anything really stand out?
Yeah, yes and no. In a more basic sense, and as you well know, Andrew, at the core, markets and people don't change. Some of the same things that were true 20 years ago, or 50 years ago, even 100 years ago, are still true today. And that's because a lot of market action derives from human emotion and human behavior, and that's sort of unchanging. However, what has changed is technology and the impact on trading. And, you know, you go back to when I wrote the first Market Wizards book in 88, and surveying people over the trading of the past, you know, 10, 20 years at that point in time. Computers, I mean, we had PCs, but we're still very early on in that state of things. And since then, we've had just this tremendous growth in computer power and the use of computers and trading, and you have a tremendous amount of quant trading and types of strategies that were not even possible to explore or let alone implement 20, 30 years ago. So that means there are different strategies that work, and types of people who might not have been involved in markets maybe many years ago, particularly in the quant side, mathematicians, physicists, so forth, that might be extracting profits out of the markets that weren't there as players a long time ago.
Now, does that profits that are at the expense of someone else? For example, we know the high frequency trading. There are some of those that are pretty much doing skimming. I mean that in a way that, you know, they're getting ahead of things and all that. Is it that happening, or is it more so that they're finding opportunities that weren't there before?
I think both. They are finding opportunities that weren't there before or couldn't be extracted. In markets where there is a zero sum game, they're extracting profits. But you take like high frequency traders. Yes, they're extracting profits. There's two sides to there's two other elements on the other side of that coin though that often don't get mentioned, and one is that there were always people extracting profits who were in the middle. I mean, the high-frequency traders are really the middlemen of today. So you go back far enough, and you had dollar bid-ask spreads in NASDAQ stocks. I mean, that was, I would argue, much worse, and the profits being extracted then were much, much greater. At least now the bid-ask spreads have collapsed because of that, and you get more liquidity. That's the second benefit. So you get more liquidity, and you change who's getting the money. The floor brokers and depending on which market, other people who occupied that middleman structure may have been squeezed out by technology. So we just have different people getting that, making money off of that function of providing liquidity. Now, whether they extract more money than used to be the case, insofar as there's so much greater volume, the answer would be yes. But per transaction, average transaction in the market, I don't know what the answer is there.
So yeah, I
suspect it's not as bad. I suspect it really hasn't changed that much, or it doesn't make things that much worse than they used to be, and it does provide greater liquidity.
Now, one of the things that you write about, I have to read this because I think this is just terrific. And again, this is who's this by? Let's see, Wiz Wiley, Little Book of Market Wizards, and I'm going to really encourage people to read this. It's only 120 pages or so.
180, but they're easy to lose. Yeah.
This is one of those things that the pages are small and they're tight, and I'm getting on an airplane. I'm going to finish it up very shortly, but this is great. Chapter 2, what's not important? What is not important? Before considering what is important to trading success, let's start with what's not important. Because what many novice traders believe is essential to trading success is actually a diversion. Many would-be traders believe that trading success is all about finding some secret formula or system that explains and predicts price moves, and that only if they could uncover the solution to market price behavior, success would be assured. That is terrific, because seriously, I cannot tell you how many times that I have found people that have asked me, like, what is the one thing that I can do, you know, almost across any stock or commodity that's going to assure trading profits? It's just not there, right?
Right. Well, yeah. And it's the way people think. The people are always looking for the easy answer. They'd like to believe, hey, they think of it like there's a specific answer to the markets and some specific formula, some specific exact way of trading, a cookbook recipe, if you will. And if they follow that, all they have to do is learn that and do it, and then they keep on making money. That's like an easy thing to do. Well, that would be nice. Of course, if it were that easy, everybody would do it, and it would go away anyway. So it just doesn't work that way. And there is no secret formula, and people who are looking for one are just kind of off in the wrong direction. There are a lot of ways to make money in the market. As I say, unfortunately, they're all very hard to find, but there are a lot of different ways. And which way is the right way is not an absolute. It is dependent very much on the particular person and their beliefs and their leanings and and what they're comfortable with. I mean, so some people might be very comfortable, might like the idea, feel comfortable using charts, and that feels good, and they can come up with trading decisions that way, and it seems to work for them. Other people think it's a bunch of just nonsense, and they'll never work for them. And you can say the same thing on the fundamental side, and the same thing for short-term versus long-term, and so on.
You know, it's interesting because when you say that, I think about how there are these trading systems and these strategies and formulations that work. I mean, I know that you could find certain things that work in some circumstances, in certain market conditions, in certain things, but it's related really to one particular instrument possibly. And to try to expand that is really where the problems come in. You know, you can look at trading patterns, and particularly from charts, on an instrument, you know, whether it's gold, whether it's S&P 500. But when you try to take that and then make that work for other stocks or maybe Forex, it fails miserably. And that's, well, that's a big problem.
Well, that's part of it, and that's true. But if it even, you know, but it might well fail in the future in the same market. It's, I think, not so much that the technique might not work in other markets and is specific to a market, because a lot of these approaches can work across markets. It's much more the point that no matter what it is, and even if it works well in a given market, even while working well in that market or group of markets, there are going to be plenty of times where it loses money. And even if that is a good approach, if someone's using it and they try it, they don't really believe in it, and they don't feel it's not really them, then when it has a couple of losses, they'll just abandon it. And they might well end up losing money, even though if they continue to use the approach, it would work, because they just don't have the inner belief. It's the reason I say that why buying trading systems is just a losing proposition. And I say that not because I know that the majority of trading systems sold, that are sold to the public are losing. For all I know, maybe the majority would make money if you applied them. I honestly don't know what the statistical breakdown there is. But I would argue that even if 80% of the systems, you know, would on balance make money if you traded them long enough, and I doubt if it's anything like that, it might well be under 50%. But even if it was a larger percentage, I would still argue that over 90% of people would lose money trading them, because every system has periods where it loses money. And since it's not their system, and since they don't have a core belief in it, as soon as it starts losing, or not as soon, but when it goes into a losing streak, at some point they'll abandon it. And they'll usually abandon it at a relative low point in equity, and will often lose money, even if that approach would have made money over the long term.
Right, and it's interesting, because there's a couple, the chapter we just mentioned, chapter 7, the best of times and the worst of times, when everything's going wrong, what to do. And then there's a chapter 12, which is losing as part of the game. That is part of, I think that's one of the things that separates the major players and the people that are successful long-term from the short-term minded, right? Is the whole idea that you're not going to win every time. First of all, there's going to be strings when you're hot, right? And there's going to be strings when you're really cold. What to do in those circumstances, whether you just stick by and continue doing what you're doing, or if you change. And for example, if you look at like a Jim Chanos, right? Jim Chanos has been really negative on the China markets and on the developers for a while. And, you know, that played out for a little bit, but then he got turned around. He was very much negative on HP, for example. I'm just picking on him because I'm just thinking through this for a second. But he was right. And, you know, but then he's going to be wrong for a while. The question is, what do you do with that? Do you take some of the money off the table and then reapply it later? Bill Ackman, who was all about Herbalife, and now he's finally getting a nice piece of it back in the latest round of the Herbalife battle. The question is, you know, how long do you stick to your principles? And what is your experience of when you talk to these market wizards about, you know, if you're wrong, when do you cut bait and do you come back to it?
Oh, boy, you hit a lot of different elements on it. There are a lot of topics there, but let's start with the last thing that you had. When you're wrong, you know, what do you do? Well, I think an important part of that, and that's very dependent on what the approach is. For really good traders, most of them will know their exit strategy before they get in. So they've already decided at what point they're going to get out. Now, for you know, for a lot of traders, they'll just be, they'll pick out, okay, I'm going to go in here and I'll give it this much room. And if it hits that point, then I'm out, or they might have a good little cancel stop in, I'll get them out. So that decision is already made. For some traders, particularly when they're value-oriented, where just the market, where it doesn't work to put a stop in, because if you're looking to buy and it goes down and nothing has changed, then it's a better value, and then it would be counter to your approach. And there are, and good value investors have to be able to live through those periods, like Warren Buffett in 1999 or whatever. So so in that case, it doesn't work that way. Or you mentioned Ackman with the Herbalife being short. Now that's of course a dangerous thing. Short is open ended, but bottom line, I guess his approach, his answer would be his methodology is as long as he's convinced of the fundamentals, he'll stay with it. And if that could be, and if his bet is not so large relative to his work where he can stand it, then I guess that's his approach. But so it's very much dependent on the individual. For most people, though, it would be best to know what the loss, what the permitted loss is going to be on any given trade before you take it. And there's a line, I think at some point, I think in the book, I say, if I was only allowed to use 10 words to give advice to people on trading, and that was it, you know, just I could only use 10 words. Those 10 words would be know where you get out before you get in, and that one line could help most people tremendously, because that is one of the biggest pitfalls that people face, is that they don't know the answer to that question, and then they end up losing a substantial amount on one or a few trades, and a couple of mistakes take them out of the game.
You talk about dynamic versus static trading, and Jimmy Balodimus, who he says, I quote in your book, I always take some money off the table when the market is in my favor. That saves me a lot of money, because when the market rallies, I have a smaller position, which obviously, you know, when he's on the short side, I suppose, there.
Yeah.
So, and you have a lot of good quotes in here. The trick is to differentiate between what you want to happen and what you know will happen. How many times have we sat there trying to will a position to you know,
That is a good line, because it gets to the heart. It's an interesting line, too. And that's, you know, some of these quotes that you read are kind of my line. Some are, many of them are from the people I've interviewed. And that is from one of the traders I interviewed. And that's a very insightful comment, in that many times we will find ourselves as in traders, investors, that we kind of have getting a sense of what's going to happen, and it may be counter to the position we hold, and yet despite that, we continue to hold the position. So, because we're hoping that the position will come back, you know, even though in a deeper sense we kind of know that it's not, you know, and so it's kind of separating that your desires about what you want to happen from what you kind of, as a trader with experience, know what will probably happen. Or you don't even have to be in a position. For example, let's say you wanted to buy a stock. It doesn't make a difference what it is. And you know the stock's at 40, and you're trying to buy it at 36, and you're really really bullish. You think it's going to 100. And then, you know, it goes down to 37. You don't quite get to your point, and it starts going up, and it goes to 40, it goes to 42. And you think, boy, the fundamentals are getting better. I could just see, you know, they're going to get all the earnings. You have all these reasons why you think it's going higher, and it's going to, then it creeps up more. And you say, all right, I could have bought it at 37. How do I buy it at 44? You know, and you just, but so in a case like that, you kind of inside know it's going higher, but you can't bring yourself to buy it because you could have bought it cheaper. Mm-hmm. And so that's also a good example of, you know, that you got to go for what you know, or yeah, you know, maybe know is too strong a word, but think in the sense of knowing what will happen rather than what you want to happen. What you want to happen is for the market in that case to come back to 36, give you a bargain, let you get in, and then go to 100.
Right.
But that may not that. But in a sense, you know, that becomes less and less likely, and yet you can't bring yourself to act.
Right, and this goes right to your chapter 10, which is on independence. So when you say, the point is, this is a quote pullout, the point is that when you listen to anyone else's opinion, no matter how skillful or smart the trader might be, I guarantee it's going to end badly. You know, but what's really funny about that is, and really if you think about this, trading and investing, there's an entire ecosystem that's around this, with media, news, subscription services, all of this that goes into play here. And I guess part of what you're talking about here, and maybe the underlying theme of that concept, is you really don't know what side anybody really is on and what their levels are and what their overall financial impact is on how the play out of what they're talking about is, right?
Yeah, that's not so much part of it. The problem there is, even if they're right, it's going to still mess you up somehow, because it's not your idea, it's not your trade, and so you may follow, you know, you may follow the recommendation, and hey, for all you know, they may they may get out, and you think that they still hold that opinion, and it goes against you, and they've done all right because they've gotten out in time. So that's part, you know, part is you don't know everything they do the day after. But the other part is they've got their own reasons, their own conviction. You don't have any conviction. Your conviction is you're following somebody else's advice. That's a very, very shallow conviction. So it's very easy to get messed up. And then people want to do something and hear somebody else say something different, and then they do that. And then that starts going the wrong way, and then they would have made money if they just stuck with their own idea, and then they get all messed up because they got the confusion between what they would have done and what they actually ended up doing because they listened to somebody else's advice. My experience is just listening to other people is just doesn't work. It not only doesn't work, it just messes people up. And when it comes to expert advice, the truth of the matter is most of the expert advice just isn't that it may be expert, but it isn't good. So and I had another book that I wrote, Market Sense and Nonsense. I think we may have talked after that book as well. And in there I have a whole chapter where I show different examples of advice people can get, you know, from whether talking head type advice or other newsletter advice, and different examples of it, and showing how actually that advice, if you looked at it as a statistician would, just taking the numbers and seeing how many times is it right, how many times is it wrong, would you have made more money than would you beat the index return or not, would you have, had our positive returns or not? If you look at the numbers cold and disheartedly, the clear facts seem to be on all these examples that you actually, the advice has a net negative value. It actually doesn't make money. It doesn't beat the indexes. On the contrary. So for all those reasons, my advice is just don't listen to anybody else. Come up with your own opinions. If you don't have enough opinions, or if you don't have confidence in your opinions, then you're not ready to trade. And if you do, then just do what you want to do and don't listen to anybody, even if they're 10 times smarter than you are.
You know, one of the things that's interesting is I think that the current market condition, as we sit here, the general last, we're going to take out the last 4 years. Let's talk about the last 6 months, has been, you need to listen to the Fed, though. Now, there's always the comment we've heard, and we've always heard, don't fight the Fed, don't fight the tape. But at the same time, the Fed is telegraphing that they are, in fact, starting to think about removing stimulus. Now, that doesn't mean it has to happen right away, and you know they go through their process of what they're doing with buying the bonds and cutting it back. But it's very interesting because the market's very jumpy, I think more jumpy than it has been historically on any kind of Fed move. But the Fed is probably one of the only ones that right now, or maybe a key player that you have to listen to at this point in this market environment. Would you agree with that?
I would make it broader. I mean, there's an old cliche, don't fight the Fed. I mean, that goes back, that I don't know when that saying first came into play. It could have been, 40 years ago, for all I know. But that, like any cliche, it's a cliche because there's a strong element of truth in it. And the idea there is that, well, central banks are not day traders.
Right.
And when they make a change of policy, they're very unlikely to flip back and forth in that policy. They're not politicians either. Like politicians may flip back and forth, right, but the Fed doesn't.
Right.
Yeah. And so central banks in general don't. They make a decision, a certain policy, and unless things change a lot, it's like an oil tanker, it takes a long time to turn it, they're not going to change it. So when they said they're going to have lower rates, well, they had lower rates, and they kept lower rates low for many, many years. I mean, since really late 2008, I guess, or whatever. So that was a long, long-term decision. Like most Fed decisions tend to be. And if the Fed starts indicating, well, we're going to eventually, raise rates or stop lowering rates or start raising rates slowly, whatever, I wouldn't doubt them. I wouldn't bet on the other side. It may not happen quickly, and you may have ups and downs, but once those trends start going, they tend to last for a long time. So I don't think it's just now. I think that's been true. That's been true my entire experience in the markets.
And let me ask you this. What is, from the people that you've interviewed, did the Fed come up a lot? And what is their overall opinion on how markets are today in the last 5, 6, 7 years compared to prior to that when the Fed wasn't so incredibly actively in, you know, marching out and commenting constantly? Is there anything that was picked up there?
I think the Fed was, the Fed always played a strong role in interest rates. And insofar as we've had some very major, back my own career, I still remember when we had interest rate, pre-Volcker, when we had bonds 13 or 14%, and we had T-bills at 20%, and Volcker coming in, Volcker coming in, and that tremendous long-term decline in rates or bull market in bonds. In fact, that's still going on. So I think. Actually, compared to that, I mean, what the Fed's doing now is probably like kids play. I mean, so I think the Fed has often had very powerful effects on interest rates and through interest rates on everything else. So I believe the Fed in history has had periods where it's been very, very, a very, very major player. I guess what's different now is that they're the only player. since politically, you have a situation where there is zero agreement to do anything. I guess the only thing that gets done is whatever the Fed's doing. So maybe more focus is on them. But it's not that the actions they're taking are anything large or extreme. In fact, the actions they're taking in recent years were different, but they had limited power because interest rates were already near zero. So they went to quantitative easing and stuff like that. But it's not that those actions were so extreme. They were different simply because we were in an unusual situation of having near zero interest rates, which took their power away from the typical tools they might have used.
Yep, exactly. Well, Jack Schwager, The Little Book of Market Wizards, available at all fine bookstores. We'll put some links on the note page for this particular one. You find all sorts of great investors that are the top of the field and some of the insight that they're giving you in a very compact and a very quick read. And I think that this is one of those books, I do really believe that this is one of those books that is one of those necessary things that you have to read, whether you're an experienced trader or whether you are, just starting out, because it gives you some really good things to either look back on and say, hey, you know what, maybe this is a good idea and I shouldn't be so set in something, or gives you something to really work with if you're just starting out. So I appreciate your time with us.
Oh, I'm glad to do it. Thank you very much.
All right, talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's going to wrap it up, and I thank you for joining me. Make sure to get all the information over on the show notes at thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and we'll see you next week with another great guest. Thanks for joining me. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented that should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.